is Americana. It is all very well to say that climate and geography and economic forces made the United States what it is today. But such a mechanistic conception of history does not take into consideration the power of the individual to hasten, to slow, or to direct and change to some extent the current of the great forces ebbing and flowing around him. I am convinced, for example, that old Robert Gibbon Johnson, by publicly eating a ripe tomato on the courthouse steps in Salem, New Jersey in 1820, an age when tomatoes were considered as poisonous as arsenic, put that vegetable or fruit in the way of becoming a primary food in the United States.
The words you have just heard are from Stuart Holbrook's Lost Men of American History. This program is Americana, the 15th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you Some Rebels, Eccentrics, and Others.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. America is, after all, a very young nation. 175 years is a long time to a man, but not much to a country. You will, I hope, forgive me for repeating these truisms. Our easy contempt for the threadbare statement is, you know, not always justified. The most remarkable thing about truisms is that they are sometimes true. Take this notion of the youth of America as a culture, for example. One of the oddities of human adolescence is its inconsistency. The girl in her early teens vacillates between an interest in cosmetics and an interest in dolls. The boy veers vocally from a basso profundo to a scratchy falsetto. This sort of inconsistency still seems to characterize a good deal of the American outlook. We've not yet decided, for example, whether we're a nation of rebels, reformers, rugged individualists, or rather conservative people who want nothing quite so much as to be indistinguishable from everyone else. Generally speaking, I think we practice conformity while retaining a strong interest in and even affection for the occasional non-conformer. I may as well tell you to begin with that I think that the rebels, the eccentrics, the non-conformers in the American present and past have a profound social value for all of us. And I should like this evening to look briefly at the careers of several of them. Some rebels, eccentrics, and others. Helen Wardell Erskine last summer published a book called Out of This World. The subtitle is A Collection of Hermits and Recluses, and that was quite enough to make me want to read the book. For one thing, I suppose that the hermit is the ultimate in eccentrics, and it's fascinating to speculate on the causes which drive men and women to retreat so thoroughly from the modern world, even to the point of denying in various ways its existence. The most famous of Miss Erskine's hermits are the Collier brothers, those exceedingly queer New Yorkers who were so much in the news a few years ago. You'll perhaps remember that the Colliers lived in Harlem, in an old house packed with junk which had been accumulating for decades. Or at least everybody thought that the Colliers lived there. Langley Collier was seen occasionally, but his brother Homer had not been outside the house for many years, and no one really knew whether he was dead or alive. One of the most fascinating segments of Miss Erskine's story is the tale of the near eviction of the Collier brothers from their Harlem fortress. It came about in this way. In 1942, the Bowery Savings Bank became quite pardonably annoyed with the Colliers. The bank held a mortgage on the Harlem house, which the brothers had ignored, interest, payments, and all, since 1931. So, in the autumn of 1942, the forces of civilization converged on the Colliers.
A chilly autumn wind straight from the East River made me clutch my coat. Reporters and photographers from other papers and news services joined me. Some of us, including two newsreel commentators with full equipment, had congregated in front of the barricaded brownstone front. Up drove a sedan containing the sheriff and three marshals, and a moving van trailed by a city ambulance.
That ambulance is in case Homer needs hospitalization,
the marshal explained. A representative of the Bowery Savings Bank, escorted by three lawyers from Cadwalder, Wickersham, and Taft, arrived next.
Well, now that we're here, I guess I might as well give the go-ahead sign.
Self-consciously, the sheriff shifted from foot to foot. Not a single protest. He and his marshals pounded on the drain pipe. No answer. The police sergeant, who claimed a nocturnal acquaintance with Langley Collier, cupped his hands to his mouth and hallooed up at the shuttered second-floor window. No answer. The sheriff nodded to the hook-and-ladder truck crew. The firemen hopped down from their perch, grabbed their ladders, and hot-footed it, hatches in hand, to the Collier areaway. Resting the ladders against the parlor floor windows, they scrambled up. A wall of newspapers and rubble made the windows impenetrable.
Well, there's nothing to do but tunnel through to the hall,
yelled the marshal after appraising the situation from a ladder. And by midday, the men emerged from their tunnel exhausted, caked with the dust of years and hungry. In 3 hours, they had gone less than 2 feet into the drawing room. At 1 p.m., when operations resumed, the number of spectators in the streets had increased to 1,000. The noise finally aroused Langley. From a strategic hideaway behind the piano, he shouted for John R. McMullen. With the aid of the firemen and police, the elderly lawyer ascended the ladder and crawled through the parlor tunnel to the hall of the besieged house. Langley, still entrenched behind the upright piano, pleaded for help. Mr. McMullen told him that unless $6,700 immediately was handed over to the Bowery Savings Bank, both he and Homer would be evicted.
Here is $6,700.
Langley waved a roll of bills above the piano. Mr. McMullen exchanged it for a fountain pen and the papers. Docilely, Langley signed. Mr. McMullen handed the papers to the skeptical bank officials. At the 11th hour, the Colliers had retrieved their home.
I was very much amused in reading Miss Erskine's preface to her book to discover that she had shown her hermit case histories to a psychiatrist, a certain Dr. Louis DeRosas. DeRosas' diagnosis is surely, in one respect, one of the oddest in the history of American medical practice. He said that, in his opinion, hermits are emotionally unbalanced, the chief symptom of their illness being that they nurse a morbid wish to be independent.
If we could trace back the pattern, we would find that hermits are quite suspicious early in life. That suspicion helps to create a need to be self-sufficient, to be free of people. Therefore, they are constantly driving themselves to be independent. They retreat because they don't want to deal with what in their minds is a hostile world. The one drive in them is to become more and more self-sufficient.
I suppose that as a piece of description, this diagnosis is as good as any. It's the values that I quarrel with. I strongly suspect that we need a good many more of these unstable people who want to be self-sufficient, rather than fewer of them. Though, of course, I hope that their self-sufficiency takes a more useful turn than the drive did in the Collier brothers. This reminds me, of course, of that fine theme song for All Eccentrics and Rebels, which I first heard Win Strachey sing last year. I think it's about time we heard it again. The title is I Don't Want to Be Adjusted.
In this world we have our troubles, sometimes lonesome, sometimes blue. But the hope of life eternal brightens all our hopes anew. I don't want to get adjusted to this world, to this world. I got a home that's so much better I want to go to sooner or later. I don't want to get adjusted to this world. I don't want to get adjusted to this world, to this world. I got a home that's so much better I want to go to sooner or later. I don't want to get adjusted to this world.
Like the hermit, the great American hobo is a sort of passive rebel against social organization. We have in this country done something rather characteristic with the hobo, the tramp, the road kid, the bum. We've taken him out of his real setting and turned him into a cleaned-up, half-romantic, fairy-tale sort of character. And, of course, we have attached to the bum a gay and jaunty song which everybody knows. Hallelujah, I'm a Bum.
Oh, why don't you work like other men do? How can I work when there's no work to do? Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Oh, I love my boss, and my boss loves me. And that is the reason I'm so hungry. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. I went to a house and I asked for some bread. The lady came out, says the baker is dead. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. When springtime does come, oh, won't we have fun? We'll throw up our jobs and we'll go on the bum. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Historically, this song is something more than a general and accidental expression of the hobo's revolt against the world. As you may know, the song in its present form is an old wobbly tune. You remember the IWW, the International Workers of the World? In pre-World War I days, the IWW was the toughest, the most belligerent, the most radical of unions. And that in a day when it wasn't easy for unions to exist at all, much less be particularly tough. One of the interesting things about the IWW was that it produced more rip-roaring songs than any other organization I can think of offhand. Maybe one reason for this was the career of Joe Hill, an IWW organizer, whose biography is eloquently set down by John Dos Passos in his novel 1919.
A young Swede named Hillstrom went to sea, got himself calloused hands on sailing ships and tramps, learned English in the forecastle of the steamers that make the run from Stockholm to Hull, dreamed the Swede's dream of the West. When he got to America, they gave him a job polishing cuspidors in a Bowery saloon. He moved west to Chicago and worked in a machine shop. He moved west and followed the harvest, hung around employment agencies, paid out many a dollar for a job in a construction camp, walked out many a mile when the grub was too bum or the boss too tough or too many bugs in the bunkhouse. Read Marx and the IWW preamble and dreamed about forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. He was in California for the Southern Pacific strike, used to play the concertina outside the bunkhouse door after supper evenings, and had a knack for setting rebel words to tune. Along the coast in cook shacks, flop houses, jungles, wobblies, hobos, bindlestiffs began singing Joe Hill's songs. They sang them in the county jails of the state of Washington, Oregon, California, Nevada, Idaho, in the bullpens of Montana and Arizona. Sang them in Walla Walla, San Quentin, and Leavenworth, forming the structure of the new society within the jails of the old.
Well, new society or not, they sang the songs anyway. The IWW succumbed, as the Encyclopedia of American History says, to a combination of vigilante action and federal prosecutions in the days of the First World War. As for Joe Hill, he took to organizing in the state of Utah, where they convicted him of killing a man and executed him by firing squad in November 1915. The IWW figured he was a martyr, and they made a song out of his death.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake Joe, says I to him, a-standing by my bed, they framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they forgot to kill went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where working men fight for their rights, you'll always find Joe Hill. You'll always find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
The trouble with rebels, while they're still alive, that is that they're such uncomfortable people to live with. The reason that so many of them succumb to firing squads and the like is that they persist in disagreeing with the majority of us. And yet, painful though it may be, rebellion has its uses. And sometimes the uses are immediate and practical ones. Stuart Holbrook, in his fascinating book, Lost Men of American History, has a chapter called The Ferments of Monomania, which he opens in this way.
It's all very well to say that climate and geography and economic forces made the United States what it is today, but such a mechanistic philosophy of history does not take into consideration the power of the individual to hasten, to slow, or to direct and change to some extent the current of the great forces ebbing and flowing around him. I believe, for instance, that if Dorothea Lynde Dix had not been born when she was, the care of the insane in the United States might well have been delayed for another half century. And I'm convinced that old Robert Gibbon Johnson, by publicly eating a ripe tomato on the courthouse steps in Salem, New Jersey in 1820, an age when tomatoes were considered as poisonous as arsenic, put that vegetable, or fruit, in the way of becoming a primary food in the United States. And all the way from mind to belly, other single-track individualists, several of them to be described only as fanatics or monomaniacs, contributed to shaping the American nation and character. The yeast of our 19th century monomanias was indeed great in its fermenting powers.
Of course, it's not always true that the specific content of an eccentric attack on the world and its problems is useful. It may be merely colorful. Witness the case of Bernard McFadden, whose story is now told by his former wife, in a biography entitled Dumbbells and Carrot Strips. McFadden, a physical culturist, eventually reached a point where he reproached the nation for having failed to elect him president. In 1950, he ran an editorial in his magazine Health Review on the subject. Beneath a portrait of himself appeared these words:
"The man who should have been elected president in 1932, instead of Franklin D. Roosevelt. America, by the strength of its forefathers, was destined to become the strongest nation on earth. In 1900, she had been given the opportunity to listen to a young man of 32 out of the Midwest, who endeavored to save his country from devitalization. He could have led America back to the strength of the forefathers and thus prevent the First World War. Instead, he was condemned by the chief priests of medicine and financial greed, just as another man aged 32 was once condemned and crucified because he dared to tell the truth. Had the nation listened to Bernard McFadden during the early years of the 20th century, he would have been the logical man for the presidency in 1932, when America was at the crossroads of national weakness. Therefore, ye who read this record, remember what should have been. And if ever it be your privilege to gaze upon the vital countenance of Bernard McFadden, then salute him and greet him as president. For the angels will nod their heads and understand, because to them, he will always be Mr. President.
One of the great nonconformists, and to me one of the most delightful in the early records of America, was a certain Thomas Morton. Morton of Marymount, as he's usually called, who won a special distinction in colonial days by spending his life in an effort to annoy the saints of the New Plymouth Colony, and particularly Governor William Bradford. Morton, it appeared, came to the New World in the company of a certain Captain Wollaston, and settled with him in Massachusetts, not far from Plymouth. Life in Massachusetts was not always profitable in those days, and after time, Captain Wollaston took a number of indentured servants he had brought with him from England, and transported them to Virginia, where he proposed to sell them. Morton, it appears, remained behind and took advantage of the captain's absence to give a party for the other indentured servants. And, as William Bradford's history puts it, after they were merry, he began to tell them he would give them good counsel. His counsel, briefly put, was to put Wollaston's lieutenant out and enter into equal partnership as free men with Morton himself. You can almost hear the quiver of indignation in Bradford's voice as he recounts these dreadful events in his history of the Plymouth Colony.
This counsel was easily received, so they took opportunity and thrust Lieutenant Fetcher out of doors, and would suffer him to come no more amongst them, but forced him to seek bread to eat and other relief from his neighbors till he could get passage to England. After this, they fell to great licentiousness and led a dissolute life, pouring out themselves into all profaneness. And Morton became lord of Misrule and maintained, as it were, a school of atheism. And after they had got some goods into their hands and got much by trading with the Indians, they spent it as vainly in quaffing and drinking both wine and strong waters in great excess, and, as some reported, 10 pounds worth in a morning. They also set up a maypole, drinking and dancing about it many days together, inviting the Indian women for their consorts, dancing and frisking together like so many furies, and worse practices, as if they had anew revived and celebrated the feast of the Roman goddess Flore, or the beastly practices of the mad Bacchanalians. They changed also the name of their place, and instead of calling it Mount Wollaston, they called it Marymount, as if this jollity would have lasted ever.
Morton himself, he was probably a man of good family, an Oxford graduate, a lawyer, and a one-time crony of Ben Jonson. Morton himself published considerably later his own account of his adventures in New England. The book is called The New England Canaan. Perhaps because he seems to have written the book chiefly to annoy his Puritan enemies, it's a delightful work. This is Morton's tale of the establishment of Marymount.
The inhabitants, having translated the name of their habitation to Marymount, and being resolved to have the new name confirmed for a memorial to after ages, did devise amongst themselves to have it performed in a solemn manner, with revels and merriment after the old English custom. They prepared to set up a maypole on the festival day, and therefore brewed a barrel of excellent beer, and provided a case of bottles to be spent with all good cheer for all comers of that day. And upon May Day, they brought the maypole to the place appointed, with drums, guns, pistols, and other fitting instruments for that purpose, and there erected it with the help of the savages that came thither of purpose to see the manner of our revels. A goodly pine tree of 80 foot long was reared up with a pair of buck's horns nailed on, somewhat near to the top of it, where it stood as a fair sea mark for directions to find out the way to mine host of Merrymount. There was likewise a merry song made, which, to make their revels more fashionable, was sung with a chorus, every man bearing his part, which they performed in a dance, hand in hand about the maypole, while one of the company sung and filled out the good liquor like Ganymede and Jupiter. This harmless mirth made by young men that lived in hope to have wives brought over to them was much distasted by the precise separatists who troubled their brains more than reason would require about things that are indifferent.
Bradford, in his history, devotes a considerable space to the many offenses committed by Thomas Morton. The fact appears to have been, however, that Morton simply annoyed the Puritan fathers beyond all endurance. The upshot of it was that they finally sent Miles Standish with 8 men to take Morton by force. Morton says that Standish's little army found him alone and captured him. So elated was the pilgrim force that they fell to drinking by way of celebration. Morton, who had prudently remained sober, managed to escape in the night and made his way to Merrymount, where Standish and his soldiers pursued him. To cut the tale somewhat short, Morton surrendered out of humanitarian motives, he claimed. His captors were less sensitive. They put to sea with him and marooned him on an island in midwinter. But Morton survived, found his way to England, and later returned to the New World, where he continued his campaign of annoying the godly separatists over a period of nearly 20 years. In the end, quite outnumbered, he was jailed, fined, and then released as harmless. Morton of Merrymount ended his days in Maine. You may wonder why we think it worthwhile to talk for half an hour about these odd and sometimes disreputable characters. Rebels, eccentrics, queer fish, all of them. Dangerous creatures, some. Need I say that I don't especially admire Bernard McFadden's notions of proper living, or the philosophy of the IWW, or even the faith of the man who proved that tomatoes are harmless. I should not care either to live next door to the Collier brothers. And yet I think it is important that such people exist and practice their eccentricities and their rebellions. I think it important that a free nation allow for and even cultivate nonconformity. We live in a world permeated with the stench of tyranny. Unless we have our rebels, our nonconformists, our honest men who don't agree with the majority, there's always the danger that we might get used to the smell.
You have been listening to Americana, the 15th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. Songs and ballads are by Chicago's well-known balladeer, Wynn Strachey. The quoted materials were read by Claire Baum and myself, Bill Gristy. The books mentioned on tonight's program were Stuart Holbrook's Lost Men of American History, published by Macmillan, Dumbbells and Carrot Strips by Mary McFadden and Emil Gauvreau, published by Henry Holt, and Helen Warden Erskine's Out of This World, published by G.B. Putnam Sons. The story of Morton of Merrymount may be read complete in George Willison's The Pilgrim Reader, published by Doubleday. John Dos Passos, 1919, is published by Houghton Mifflin. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address in a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is the NBC Radio Network.